Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Africans are asking President Obama to take action on the only bill he passed as a U.S. senator, and thousands protest America's wars on both coasts.
But first, John Thompson spent 18 years, much of it on death row, for a robbery and murder he did not commit. But the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that Thompson should not get $14 million awarded him in a suit against the prosecutors who tried to have him executed. Ronald Gauthier wrote a book about Thompson's experiences. It's called Killing Time.
I've been following this case now for since its beginning, since its very inception, when John Thompson first sued the district attorney's office in Orleans Parish over 2 years ago and actually won against the district attorney's office a landmark $14 million for. The case was appealed through the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and he won twice under appeal. And then when it went before the Supreme Court, we were a little concerned about that because of the views of some of the conservative justices. So I followed it all the way until the absolute final decision. And, of course, we're a little alarmed about that because what that means for Americans, most especially minorities, and particularly poor African-American males who usually can't find adequate defense.
Mr. Thompson spent a great deal of the 18 years that he was imprisoned, 14 years of it, on death row, and that was in Angola State Prison.
That's correct. 14 years at Angola State Penitentiary for a crime he didn't commit. Bear in mind that John was fortunate because two attorneys decided to do pro bono work and take his case. But let me tell you that during his post-conviction release strategies, they failed every level they went to. And John was told at one point in April of 1999 that his execution would actually be carried out. There was nothing to stop it at that point. Now, amazingly, a private investigator working for them found the evidence in a police vault, the blood sample, that John Thompson was actually not the person who committed an armed carjacking in New Orleans. So that led to further investigation, and she was able to find 10 pieces of evidence to prove John's innocence that was not turned over to his defense almost 18 years earlier.
And yet the prosecutors claimed that they couldn't find it. Do you think the prosecutors actually knew this evidence existed, or is this evidence of prosecutors who deliberately don't look for exculpatory evidence?
In this particular case, from the research we've done, the prosecutors absolutely were aware of the evidence. One of the things the investigator was able to find was information to show that prosecutors signed out information. So the information disappeared. Then it returned after the trial. So definitely they were aware of some of the statements from witnesses. One particular was pretty alarming because the witness described the killer as 6'2" with close-cropped haircut. And John Thompson, when he was arrested, was 5'7", large afro. Prosecutors had information to that, and that information was not submitted to the defense. And bear in mind that that's a violation of the Brady Law, which clearly states that a prosecutor has a legal and moral obligation to submit any information that's preferential to the defense to that defense attorney, and that didn't happen in this case. The Brady Law was violated.
From your layman's standpoint and from this research that you've done as a professional writer, is there any crime that a prosecutor can commit that can at least get him disbarred?
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem. First of all, in the United States Supreme Court case Imbler versus Patchman in 1976, the United States Supreme Court ruled at that time that prosecutors enjoy complete immunity from civil liability. So if the misconduct is egregious, if it's willful and malicious, that doesn't allow the plaintiff a right to sue and to get damages. So they had that protection already. What John Thompson's lawyers did in this particular case in civil court was they sued under a theory of municipal liability, that the district attorney didn't properly train his staff, especially on Brady law and Brady violations, that they weren't supervised properly. Now, bear in mind that that was a very narrow window to begin with, and now the Supreme Court closed that very narrow window, so you absolutely cannot sue them for anything now. The only thing you can do when a prosecutor commits misconduct is to make a complaint with the State Bar Association, and from the research we've done, that very rarely results into anything. So there are, they've got the green light to just go ahead with the misconduct now.
This might seem to be the definition of a police state or a prosecutorial state.
Well, most definitely. What terrifies me, too, is the research we did. There was one particular study I looked at that was commissioned by the Center for Public Integrity, and it was a study that covered prosecutorial misconduct in this country from 1973 to 2003. Now, they looked at all of those cases. They left out cases that dealt with federal prosecutions. They didn't take into fact cases where maybe a defendant had the charges dropped. So the numbers would be much higher than the 3,017 that we looked at. Now, bear in mind, these are numbers in which prosecutors were caught red-handed committing misconduct. And there were other studies out there to show that it can be rampant. So it still exists, and now with the Supreme Court's decision, we just don't have a deterrent effect. We don't have anything to force district attorneys to ensure the integrity of their offices. And the people at large, we're in trouble. We're in a lot of trouble in this country.
Everyone who comes from neighborhoods like I come from know that prosecutors routinely pile on every crime that has been committed in a neighborhood on a subject in order to clear cases, that police and prosecutors do this routinely. That is a variant on the same crime or the same injustice that Mr. Thompson was subjected to.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, in John's case, he was charged with the murder of Ray Lauza, a wealthy hotel executive in New Orleans in 1984. So you could imagine at that time the pressure was on the district attorney's office to find someone and get them convicted and do it right away. So John was arrested. John came from a poor neighborhood, tough, a former drug dealer, so it was easy for them to pin it on him, and they were able to do that. But the problem that brings to the community is that we had a murderer at large walking the streets that nobody's looking for. We have an innocent man in prison, and we have prosecutors who are committing this misconduct with discomfort level. And it's just so unfortunate that 18 years later, when we had the opportunity to stop it with a Supreme Court decision, the high court justices just shirked the responsibility. They didn't do what they really needed to do here.
And so we have a situation in which, objectively speaking, the prosecutors were working in collusion with whoever was guilty of the crime, and the Supreme Court has sanctioned that kind of behavior.
Exactly. And when I think, you know, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the majority opinion, and I guess I have such difficulty with that when I think here's a man who at one time told 20 million viewers who watched him say he was a victim of a high-tech lynching for uppity blacks. The irony amazes me to think that now he makes a decision that creates in this country a high-tech lynching culture. He gives a green light to prosecutors, rogue prosecutors, to go out here and incarcerate innocent people, send them to death row, send them to prison with long sentences. Is that not the behavior of a lynch mob? And he's created that. The irony is just shocking to me.
And he did it face-to-face with a man who had faced being lynched 8 times, I believe.
Exactly. You know, John came so close. He had 7 days of execution while he was on death row. That means they brought the warrant to his cell to let him know he would be killed shortly. You know, just imagine how emotionally shattering that is. And to be in a jail like this, a prison, Angola State Penitentiary, and to be innocent, to know you're innocent. That alone just it exacted a psychological torture unlike anything imaginable. And the prosecutors had over 20 years, close to 20 years, to make this thing right. And even when the information was discovered, all of the evidence that had not been turned over to his attorney, he was retried by the district attorney's office. And it took less than 35 minutes for the jury to acquit him of all charges.
Thousands took to the streets in San Francisco and New York to protest U.S. wars around the planet. The demonstrations were organized by UNAC, the United National Anti-War Committee. The New York protests drew 10,000 people. We have presentations from Janine Yazzie reading a letter from political prisoner Leonard Peltier of the American Indian Movement, who has spent the last 3.5 decades behind bars. Ralph Poynter is the husband, a radical lawyer, and now political prisoner, Len Stewart. But first, we'll hear from Black Agenda Report's own Glenn Ford.
Power to the people. It's an honor to be here among the honorable people of the real anti-war movement, the one that doesn't shut down just because a slick corporate lawyer with a black face becomes the chief warmongerer. This is a movement that opposes all imperial racist wars, not just Republican imperial racist wars. This, we think, is an anti-war movement that is worthy of the name because it's not afraid to say the name of the chief perpetrator of those wars, Barack Obama. You can't oppose the wars without opposing the war maker. We at Black Agenda Report and at the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations have always maintained that Barack Obama is not the lesser of two evils. He is the more effective and efficient evil because he's accomplished more of the right-wing agenda than the Republicans alone could ever hope to do. It was candidate Barack Obama who came to the rescue of George Bush's bank bailout back in October 2008, after Bush had failed to push it through Congress. Barack Obama expanded George Bush's imperial wars, and he has become the mad bomber of North Africa. We know that there is a war going on right here at home. That's why there are 1 million captured black prisoners. 1 out of every 8 prisoners on the planet is an African American. But we are finally mobilized. The hour is late, but we are here to reset the clock. Power to the people.
Greetings, and thank you for giving an old warrior a few minutes of your time. No one knows the cost of war more than the older, wiser warrior. Once we have fought the battles, we realize that those who bear the greatest burden of war are those most vulnerable, those without power or influence. They are the ones who suffer the most from any war. Since World War II, non-combatants have become the primary victims of modern warfare. Someone must be their voice. The United States has not had a single year of existence without soldiers in a combat zone, not in over 230 years. That is not to say that I hate or that anyone should hate this country. It is simply a statement of fact. The U.S. spends as much on its wars as the rest of the world put together. The U.S. Air Force is the largest in the world, and the second largest Air Force in the world is the U.S. Navy. That's right. Add up Russia, China, Germany, England, France, and more. The American Navy is bigger than all of them put together. President Eisenhower warned us many years ago of the military-industrial complex and its impact on the world. What do you do with all these shiny tools of destruction? You don't spend billions of dollars on war plans and warships so they can sit around and rust. You must use them if for no other reason than to justify their existence. So again, you, the people who gather here and elsewhere today, you are the voice of those who are called collateral damage, the unrepresented, the disappeared, the casualties of wars. Raise your voices as one in righteous indignation against the military-industrial complex. Become the power of peace and the counterbalance to the insanity of war as the Creator intends us to be. Strive to live in balance and teach your children to live in harmony with Earth and all of life.
I'm not going to make a speech. You've heard the speeches, you've heard the issues, but Lynn's issue is this. We must face the corporate juggernaut with a unified struggle, and that struggle must be to stop the empire of capitalism. And we can do that with general strike. Keep your money in your pocket. Spend nothing but housing and food. General strike, do not allow the unions or the Democratic Party to take us away from general strike. You can
Next up is our own Nellie Bailey of Harlem Fight Back Against War at Home and Abroad. Nellie's presentation is followed by Chris Gavreau, one of the chief organizers at the United National Anti-War Committee.
Brothers and sisters, we stand here together on this great day of outrage and protest against Obama's wars at home and abroad. President Obama just had a deal with his twin, the Republican Party. $38 billion cut in federal spending over the next 6 months. But we know what is coming because of President Obama's chilling war. He said programs people rely on will be cut. The American people have to live within their means. An echo of the same lie as the right-wing Republican Party. We asked the president, where is the $3 trillion in uncollected corporate taxes since 2001? $858 billion in the extension of
demonstration was Vijay Prashad, Director of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. We caught up with Dr. Prashad after the protest and asked him about the politics behind the rebellion against Muammar Gaddafi in Libya.
From when the rebellion begins in February, it has a cast of characters that resembles a little bit the kind of rebellions that we saw in Tunisia and Egypt. In other words, they were human rights activists. The 39-year-old Fateh Terbil had been arrested on February 15th, 2 days before the fifth anniversary of the Danish cartoon protests in Benghazi, in which 11 people had been killed. So in anticipation of any protest on February 17, they arrested this human rights lawyer. So the early rebellion was human rights lawyers, people involved with the February 17th movement, and various other groups in Benghazi and in eastern Libya particularly, who had a long-standing set of grievances against Gaddafi. They were joined in western cities, in working class areas largely, where people have had all kinds of grievances, the cutback in transfer payments, rise in prices of goods, etc. So it was a general rebellion from below of ordinary people. But within 10 days or so, the complexion of the leadership changed. In other words, by early March, the people in charge were either defectors from the Gaddafi regime, and most of them were on the right wing of the regime. People like Mahmoud Jibril, who'd been involved in the privatization of the 11,000 firms under state control in Libya. So he was one of the great characters. Then the former interior minister ran the military wing of the rebellion, and to assist him comes a man from the United States, Khalifa Hifter, who is a colonel, was a colonel in the Libyan army. So by early March, the rebellion had taken on a different kind of leadership. And it is that leadership that signaled to the UN Security Council, the United States, the French, and the British particularly, that they wanted some kind of air support for their troops. So I think that's the first switch in the character of the rebellion. The second switch that takes place is when it becomes clear that despite NATO and U.S. bombing and despite the U.S. use of AC-130 planes over Libyan skies, when a stalemate broke out around Ras Lanuf and Astabia and Brega and those cities, it didn't seem like anybody was able to make much ground. At that point, incredible disagreement has broken out in Benghazi among the leadership, some wanting more support from the international community, which really here means the United States, NATO, and the French, and others wary of this and open to political dialogue. And it's into that breach, as it were, that the African Union's delegation has now come. Because right now it seems that in both Tripoli and in Benghazi, there is a split in both leaderships vis-a-vis the military and the political option.
The African Union is not very popular among some segments of the rebels in Benghazi, is it?
Yeah, and I understand their lack of enthusiasm. After all, Gaddafi was for many years the principal economic sponsor of the African Union, and it has been my view that sponsorship has actually prevented the AU, the African Union, from coming into its own. The African Union is a very important development, and it needs to be, it needs to be pushed forward. It needs to deepen its understanding of its role in interstate relations and so on. But, partly as a result of the lack of financing from elsewhere, and then Gaddafi coming in and becoming the principal sponsor, had to some extent prevented the African Union from really shining. It is clear to people in Benghazi that the African Union has some commitments to Gaddafi that may not be so easy to walk away from. On the other hand, it's also the case that Jacob Zuma, president of South Africa, asked his ambassador in the United Nations to vote on behalf of Resolution 1973, despite the fact that the Indian, Brazilians, and South Africans had entered that meeting with the assumption that they would all abstain from that vote and not vote on it. Because these three countries, India, Brazil, and South Africa, are part of the so-called IBSA group, which has been meeting since 2003. So the assumption was that South Africa would vote as to abstain alongside Brazil and India, and they didn't. They voted for the resolution. So in that sense, in Benghazi, one would imagine that Jacob Zuma would have some credibility, because after all, he authorized Resolution 1973. So it was really quite strange that when the African Union delegation left Tripoli and went to Benghazi, Zuma did not accompany the group. He left from Tripoli back to South Africa. And hence, the group that arrived in Benghazi was Absent Zuma. I thought that was a very peculiar message to send. If credibility needed to be built, if this was to be a serious maneuver, it was important that Zuma also go to Benghazi. I'm not clear why he did not.
But certainly it does remove some of the credibility or political clout from the AU delegation.
Yeah, it's a very bad decision for him not to have gone there. I mean, he was of the lot. He was, I think, one of the few that could have said, you know, we supported 1973, and now we are asking you to start a political dialogue. You know, I mean, he would have had the credibility, whereas the others didn't have that credibility. And so I think this is a lost opportunity.
The rebels have complained that they're not getting the kind of close air support that they want from the foreign forces. Are they just whining about their own inadequacies, or do you think that some level of close air support has actually been withdrawn?
You know, the United States was using the AC-130 and A-10-2 Thunderbird in the early days of the so-called no-fly zone. Now, those kind of aircraft are not actually to produce a no-fly zone. Those are what I consider to be boots in the air. In other words, these are planes that can hover at low altitudes, and using small bore cannon, they fire at ground troops and at, things like tanks. So those are, you know, tantamount to being boots on the ground, except that they are in the air. And then when the United States handed over the command of the no-fly zone to NATO, it withdrew these aircraft. So, yes, they have been providing close ground support, and then that was taken away. So the rebels are quite correct to complain. The problem, of course, is that the use of AC-130 and A-10-2 Thunderbolt is a violation of Resolution 1973, because Resolution 1973 resolves for member states to protect civilians in Libya, not to assist the rebellion. And that ambiguity was utilized by the United States to send these kind of aircraft. It's very hard now for the rebels to turn to Resolution 1973 and say, send those aircraft back. You know, so they are caught in a very difficult place. Having once experienced the advantage of those planes, now they are disadvantaged. And, I mean, on top of that, Resolution 1973 actually opens the door to arms shipments, because there is a very crucial paragraph in the resolution which says that the member states can provide all necessary measures, comma, notwithstanding Resolution 1970. Resolution 1970 was the resolution from February which said that there should be an arms embargo on Libya. So what 1973 says, the member states must give all necessary measures, comma, notwithstanding 1970, which means despite what 1970 says. The door for arms shipments to the rebels is open, and I think they are trying to point to that as well.
Yes, the resolution actually would forbid close air support, which has no other purpose than to facilitate the movement of troops on the ground. We've been hearing for many, many weeks that arms are coming through the Egyptian border.
Yes, that story has been there, that, from Egypt, arms are coming in. There has also been story that an expeditionary force is on the ground. That may be the case, but what definitely is not there yet is the kind of major arms shipments that the rebellion would need if they want to at least achieve maybe Zintan, Misrata, and then finally into Tripoli. And that would mean, surface-to-air missiles, the kind of arms that were sent to any Contra-like force which is going to lay siege to a capital city. I mean, I'm thinking now of Kabul, circa the 1990s, when the Mujahideen finally encircles the city and essentially fires, surface-to-air rockets into the city and butchers neighborhoods and civilians. I mean, that's what, if this dynamic continues in this way, that's where it will end up. Tripoli will become like Kabul.
Now, we shared with you earlier a report from a person named Bonnie, listed as a prominent member of the rebel council, who charged that Chad had 3,600 regular troops fighting for the Gaddafi government. You said that this guy, Bonnie, doesn't speak for anybody. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, he's a spokesperson for the military, the rebel military. So certainly he must speak for them, I would imagine. But there's a problem here. You know, it would be a serious violation if the Chadian government had sent troops into Libya, and certainly it would have been noted by the so-called, you know, proponents of the no-fly zone. I mean, they have satellites flying over Libya. They have their eyes are looking at everything happening. And if they have not pointed this out, I would find it very peculiar. I think this is almost like when the third NATO so-called mistake took place and they killed 13 rebel soldiers. A rebel colonel from Benghazi said that this was not a NATO attack, it was an attack by the Libyan armed forces. He said a small Libyan plane from the west flew in and dropped a bomb and killed 13 people. It was not NATO. I mean, that was preposterous. This has the same kind of smell.
The uninitiated observer might get the impression that there are many tens of thousands of troops involved on both sides, but the actual numbers involved are much smaller than that, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, one doesn't know exactly how many people are on either side because, for one, the eastern command of Gaddafi's army has largely defected to the rebellion, and one never knew anyway what the total numbers of troops under command are. I mean, these are not... Libya is a difficult society for journalists, so it's always hard to get very good information on things like this. These are not publicly available data. So it's hard to say what the numbers are, but by all accounts from the battlefield, these are not big engagements. You know, we're not talking the Battle of the Somme or some major frontline assault in Vietnam. You know, these are small engagements, a tank unit moving here, being fired on, etc. But it's true when the cities are involved, you know, columns of troops have come in. But again, these are not large numbers. These are not, you know, 20,000, 40,000, 50,000 on either side arrayed. These are in the low, you know, hundreds, thousand people, nothing like that.
The government of Chad has made a formal complaint asking that the United Nations protect its civilians in those areas of rebel-held territory.
Well, you know, my feeling is it's a rather odd business because the so-called people who are involved and interested in humanitarian intervention have said almost nothing about the many foreign workers who are trapped in the oil fields. I mean, one of the petty scandals of the oil industry is that many, many of the workers in the oil fields are not nationals of the countries where the oil is pumped out of, but they come from elsewhere. And we got to see a little bit of that from the western border, when out of Tripoli, Egyptian workers, Tunisian workers fled across the border to Tunis and then out on ships. And many also from South Asia. Well, it's a very great scandal that on the eastern side, the Egyptian army has not demanded the opening of a refugee corridor from Ashtabia or Benghazi to the Egyptian border to allow war refugees to leave the country. I mean, they're trapped in the eastern side, and nobody seems to be paying much heed to their departure. You know, I would imagine that in the context of a civil war, a priority for the UN Security Council and its humanitarian wing would be the opening of war corridors to allow refugees to leave. And I'm afraid nobody has made any noise about that.
Professor Pershad is author of the book, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World.
A new report confirms that the United States accounts for nearly half of all weapons spending on the planet. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute says the total amount spent on weapons in the world is about $1.6 trillion. For a further breakdown of the numbers, we spoke with John Pfeffer, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies.
The United States represents somewhere between 40 and 45% of global military spending and has been responsible for the vast majority, upwards of 90% of the increase in military spending over the last year globally. And that's part of a doubling of both global military expenditures over the last decade and a doubling of U.S. military spending. So, yes, the United States basically drives international military spending, and thus it is the responsibility of organizations here in the United States to make sure that the military budget is part of the discussion of budget priorities here in Washington.
Yeah, and 40 to 45% of the total really is not the measurement of it. That doesn't count U.S. allies, or Britain, France, and so many others, does it?
No, it doesn't. And it also is a rather conservative estimate because, in fact, it uses only the base budget and the overseas contingency operations and this nuclear budget from the Department of Energy. But there's a lot of other military spending here in the United States that falls under other department budgets, whether it's the State Department or Homeland Security or the intelligence services. So while the number that's traditionally used is between $650 and $700 billion, U.S. military spending is actually closer to $1 trillion.
And let's put it in perspective. What is the spending of those nations that could, by any reasonable measurement, be considered potential adversaries of the United States?
Well, if you add them all up, they come out to considerably less than what the United States alone spends on the military. If you look at the nearest potential rival, which would be China, China spends somewhere between a tenth and a seventh of what the United States spends on the military. Of course, it's sometimes difficult to think about China as a rival since we're so dependent on it economically. So to declare war on China would be like declaring war on Walmart, for instance, since China is responsible for so many of the products that we buy at Walmart and other wholesalers and retailers here in the United States. But if you look at some of the other adversaries that we are currently fighting wars against, the numbers are even smaller. Certainly Al-Qaeda does not have much of a military budget whatsoever. Gaddafi in Libya also has a very, very small military budget in comparison to what the United States spends or our allies spend. So we are not just dominant in terms of military spending, we are completely dominant in how we overshadow the spending of all other adversaries and potential adversaries.
So we're not talking about the exigencies of military threat. What is the driving force behind this military expenditure?
Well, a lot of it is inertia. In other words, we've been spending this for so long, it's very difficult for us to turn off the spigot. There's a tremendous amount of money involved in this, obviously. If you're talking about $700 billion, that money has to end up somewhere, and it ends up to a large extent in the pockets of defense contractors. Those defense contractors exert a lot of influence here in Washington. But there is also the issue of jobs. The defense contractors have been very smart in terms of making sure that the production lines for their weapon systems are very evenly distributed across the United States so that virtually every representative in Congress has a defense contractor and therefore some jobs related to defense spending in their district. And it becomes very difficult for them to vote against a weapon system if it means, on the face of it at least, throwing people out of work. And so that has been a major obstacle in reducing military spending here in the United States.
Now, when we're talking about military spending and vast expansions in raw spending, that's not a full measure of the military's expanded role in terms of U.S. policy either. In many arenas, especially in Africa, the military is assuming duties and responsibilities that were previously part of the civilian sector, the State Department, for example.
That's correct. And, you know, if you do a comparison, the State Department, for its base budget, for 2012 at least, is asking for somewhere around $50 billion. That's less than a tenth of what the Pentagon gets. Because all the money that's available in the Pentagon, a lot of the services, a lot of the activities that had previously been State Department activities basically have gone where the money is, and that's Pentagon. So that delivery of humanitarian relief for instance, has increasingly become part of Pentagon's mission, as you said, particularly in Africa, specifically under the new Africa Command. And there have been a number of different basically services and capabilities that have been put on Pentagon's shoulders. And there are a lot of people in the Pentagon that are not happy about that. I'm not talking about the upper crust of the Pentagon. I'm talking about the people who actually have to implement these programs on the ground because they're not necessarily trained for this. They encounter hostility. There isn't necessarily a lot of interagency cooperation. And so this creates a great deal of friction. So this is the problem with what we might call mission creep for Pentagon. It's mission creep not related to a particular war. It's mission creep related to the overall capabilities of the Pentagon.
And in some areas, the State Department is actually becoming more militarized. For example, Iraq, where the United States is building its biggest embassy in the world as it pulls out military personnel from Iraq, is planning to have 15,000 people headquartered at the State Department's headquarters in the embassy who clearly will be doing military work.
That's correct. And, you know, the State Department has a separate budget. I referred to its base budget, but it has a separate budget that's actually military in nature, and that covers the State Department's engagement in military operations overseas. So this is also a great kind of problem that faces the United States at the moment. We've not only seen the tremendous kind of cancerous growth of Pentagon spending, but we've seen it kind of distort and otherwise transform what had previously been non-military and therefore in many cases benign, not always benign, but in many cases benign activities of the State Department to help people overseas. But to the extent that the State Department becomes associated in the public mind, but the public here and the public abroad, with military missions of the United States, that compromises the integrity of our diplomatic activities.
When President Obama came in, there was a great deal of talk about, well, now we're going to see a period of an emphasis on U.S. so-called soft power. But the numbers don't tell that tale, do they?
No, and, you know, that was a great promise from President Obama as a candidate, that he would focus on diplomacy, that he would reach out his hand in diplomatic overtures to countries overseas if they were interested in negotiations. But we've seen that this hand that we reach out is actually a fist in many cases. It's a fist simply in terms of how much money we spend on the military. It's also a fist in terms of the ongoing military operations, not only in Iraq and Afghanistan, not only in Libya, not only the drone war that's run by the CIA in Pakistan, but in dozens and dozens of counterterrorism operations all around the world, which have increased under the Obama administration. And so we have not seen the promised transformation of the United States into a more cooperative actor in the international sphere. We've seen a continuation of basically what was a Bush-style foreign policy from the early part of this millennium.
And how does this historic ongoing continuity of militarization distort the domestic economy?
Well, whenever we put so much money into the military and then leave it off the table in any kind of budget discussions, it inevitably means that we have less money available to deal with our rather large domestic problems. So, for instance, President Obama said during the budget deficit discussions that there'll be a freeze on non-military discretionary funding. In other words, that part of the budget which we have some political control over, it doesn't include Social Security or Medicare, that there would be a freeze on that non-military discretionary spending, but no freeze on the military. And in fact, if you look at the 2012 budget, you see a modest increase in U.S. military spending, even as basically both sides of the aisle here in Washington complain about both the budget deficit and the lack of money available for necessary human services. So that's the key problem. I mean, we see the deterioration of infrastructure. We see that we don't have enough money to cover our new health care plan. We don't have money to shrink the U.S. carbon footprint. There are any number of urgent tasks that we have to face here in the United States, urgent tasks that require money. And we simply don't have that money available because it's all tied up in the Pentagon.
And the regimes, the countries in what we used to call the third world, can even less afford this global militarization.
That's true. And one of the very sad statistics from last year in terms of military spending in 2010 is that some of the regions of the world that could really do with a reduction in military spending saw the opposite. So, for instance, in both Africa and South America, those two regions saw an increase in military spending of 5%, which is actually quite remarkable. Europe saw a decline for the first time since 1997, but Africa and Latin America have been going up. And in part, this, again, is fueled by the United States, not just the United States, but by the United States and our arms export policies. We export about $40 billion a year, going up possibly to $50 billion this year in 2011. And we encourage countries, whether they're our allies or even not, to buy as many weapons from us as possible. And so we encourage them to have these distorted budget priorities. It's not just us, as I say. We compete with Russia and China and France for this lucrative arms market. But nonetheless, we're number one in terms of arms exports here in the United States. So we take a leading role in encouraging these kinds of distorted budget priorities.
John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies speaking from Washington.
President Obama passed only one piece of legislation while he was a member of the U.S. Senate. The bill called for appointment of a special U.S. envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa, site of the genocides in Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. But as president, Obama has failed to make the appointment. The Africa Faith and Justice Network is asking that Obama obey his own law. Jock Bahati explains.
The reason we are asking President Obama to send a special envoy to the Great Lakes is very simple. This is a U.S. law. When President Obama was a senator, he led a bill. We call it the Obama bill, but it was signed into law by President George Bush. And in its section 107, it clearly says that they should appoint a special envoy to the Great Lakes for the reasons that are very simple. That person will coordinate the effort to bring stability in the region. And the question is, why has not that law been implemented to date since 2006?
President Obama didn't sponsor too many laws when he was briefly in the Senate.
The speculation we have and the doubt we have is that he has around him people who worked in the former government, which is the Clinton government, and those people put up some of the policies for the Great Lakes, which did not really go fine. It was in 1994. When we had the genocide in Rwanda and President Clinton was in office, and shortly after we had the invasion of Congo, and basically if these people who made those policies are around Obama today, they have to revisit those policies and possibly contradict themselves, because those policies they made then, they did not work. We had Susan Rice at the United Nations. She was a key person in the Clinton administration, and there you are asking her to revisit some of her policies. I do believe that probably that is one of the challenges that Obama is facing. There is money attached to that bill, but that should not be an issue, because 52 million, whatever number it is, that is not a big money, and I don't think money is always what Africans need, but they want policies that works for them and gives them the room to manage. They don't want support for the regimes that are oppressive, and that is one of the biggest problem that we have in the Great Lakes.
And those regimes, as it relates to the deaths of 5.4 million Congolese, those regimes that were found partially culpable are U.S. allies, Rwanda and Uganda. It would seem the United States doesn't need a special envoy to know what they're doing, since the U.S. is so closely linked to them.
Exactly. We know that the U.S. has a cozy relationship with the regimes in the Great Lakes. And therefore, we believe that in good faith, they can influence them to do the right thing. What they have been supporting them to do is to remain in power. With U.S. influence, they can ask them, meaning ask their friends, to understand that unless there is democracy in the Great Lakes and in every respective country in the Great Lakes, there will not be prosperity. However, we have to understand that the West has kept African nations weak because through that weakness that also they come up as superpowers. You don't want a competing power. If African nations were to prosper, there will not be the concept of foreign aid because they will be able to probably pay off their debts and then be able to pay their citizens. And what would become those powers? That is an issue of policy, and it's an issue of vision. You have to have the poor to speak about the rich.
So you're saying your priority is not to get more foreign aid, although I guess dollars are always welcome as long as there aren't strings attached, but your priority is actually a change in U.S. policy.
Our priority has always been a change in U.S. policy. Those policies that are positive, we welcome them. Or the policies that are more the statu quo kind of policy are not welcome. The simple example is Uganda, for example, whereas we have AFRICOM working alongside with the Ugandan military. Today, as I speak with you, we have news that Museveni's forces, or whatever, police, is cracking down on peaceful demonstration in Kampala. What kind of regime is that? We need freedom of speech. We need freedom of assembly. Anywhere in the world where you have people free, you see prosperity coming along. Therefore, we will not have poverty reduced. We will not have prosperity in these countries if there is no freedom. And it is unconscionable to see that a nation like the U.S. can continue to hold on a friendship with those kind of regimes without really going on the side of the people and say, you know what, there will not be any more military aid to you if you continue to keep the system closed and not opening up to freedom and to the people's participation.
So the winds of change would be blowing through sub-Saharan Africa as they are in other parts of the world, except for repressive regimes, some of them linked to the United States.
Exactly. The U.S., I mean, the president has spoken in favor of the wave of change that is coming out of the North Africa. As always, when you hear politicians, you have to hear them and always ask yourself, is this an honest assessment? And we want to believe here at Africa Faith and Justice Network that that is an honest understanding and honest policy expression. However, we want to see action that accompanies words. We will not believe it as long as we see that those relationships with dictatorial regimes continues and that people are still victims of U.S. support of those dictatorships. That is very simple.
You are from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The last time we spoke to you a couple of months ago, you were still waiting on the United States to have at least some kind of substantive reaction to the United Nations report that said that Uganda and Rwanda were culpable in the death of millions in Congo. Have you seen any sign of a U.S. response since that time?
No, I would say that there have not been any significant sign. What we saw was a hearing, I believe it was on March 2nd, on the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The only significant articulation of policy was the envoy to the Great Lakes. And this was articulated by the panel and also the chairman of the subcommittee on Africa, Congressman Christopher Smith. However, there wasn't any mention of the UN mapping report, which was a disappointment for people like me and the Africa Faith and Justice Network, along with the coalition that is pushing for transparency and justice for the victims killed in Congo. it is imperative to understand that if there is no justice, there will not be stability. If people are left to just be free after committing crimes, there is no accountability, there is no democracy. Therefore, it is urgent that the U.S. take a stand on the UN mapping report, and more so that the U.S. take leadership in holding accountable those who are named in the report. The names are very clear: the Rwandan regime, also the Ugandan regime, also the Congolese people, everyone associated to the crimes. Some critics say that we are going after the Rwandan regime alone. No, we go after the Rwandan regime, or we name the Rwandan regime, because they were the one on the front line killing people. However, we equally condemn and go after the Congolese who were associated with these crimes. There is no small crime. The answer to any crime is justice.
That was Jacques Bahati of the Africa Faith and Justice Network.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Matt Bogart.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.